So today I would like to talk a little bit about my current interest, which is how we can use future observations to discover something about the early universe. So this is an outline of my talk. I will be starting from, I'll give a very, very brief overview on inflation. And then I will discuss a little bit about signatures that arise from a coupling between a long mode and a short mode from inflation. And this is based on work with Matteo Fasiello, Marco Minkowski, and Dong-Wei Xiaong. And then I will, in the second part of my talk, I will discuss a little bit about spectral distortions of the cosmic microwave background and how we can use this to test inflation on the smaller scales and on to find out about physics beyond the standard model. And this is these are the references my second part is based on. So it's work with Jens Kluba, Mustafa Amin, Marco Minkowski, Razia Emani, and Lawrence Krauss. And then to conclude, I will briefly mention some work on primordial gravitational waves from inflation. And this is with Matteo Fasiello, Tomohiro Fujita, Matteo Biagetti, and Marco Peloso. Okay, so I'm interested in the very early universe and what the cosmic microwave background and the large scale structure can tell us about it. And as we all know, this audience, I guess, doesn't need much introduction. The cosmic microwave background was released when electrons and became bounded in nuclei, the photons became free to propagate at the redshift of about 1100. And so they propagate freely until very late times. And if we look at the cosmic microwave background, we see that the temperature is nearly uniform across the sky, even between regions that are back then when the CMB was released were not in causal contact with each other. And inflation provides an explanation as to why these regions were somehow aware of each other. So inflation is what we indicate by inflation is an era of accelerated expansion in the very early universe. So during this time, the horizon size was approximately constant, whereas all the physical scale was stretched by the expansion. And in the simplest realization, inflation is driven by a scalar field with a constant, with an isotropic and homogeneous background and superimposed quantum fluctuations. So this quantum fluctuation, just like all physical scales were stretched during inflation. They became super horizon sized. They froze, and those are what we believe the seeds for the fluctuations we observe in the CMB temperature and polarization, and for the large scale structure. So when we talk about the simplest inflation paradigm, we think about one scalar field slowly rolling down its potential. So in order to have an accelerated expansion, you need a scale factor with a double second derivative that is positive. And this is realized if you take a scalar field which is dominated by its potential energy. So the equation of state becomes p equals minus rho. And then in order to have enough inflation, you need to assume that the derivatives of v are small, and hence we define slow roll parameters. So we have learned about inflation from looking, for instance, at the angular power spectrum for temperature and isotropies on very large angular scales. So we know that the power spectrum on large angular scale is connected to the power spectrum of primordial fluctuations. And we know that this power spectrum is nearly scale invariant, and we know that with very high precision. We know that an S deviates from one, and that's a 5 sigma measurements. And the other important prediction from inflation is a stochastic gravitational waves background, which we haven't observed yet, but on which we have some bounds. And this is what we define as a tensor to scalar ratio. Okay, so this is a little bit overview of what we know so far, but what we don't know is really a lot more. So we really don't know exactly. So first of all, we don't have a definite confirmation that inflation happened. We don't know, and if inflation happened, we still don't know much about its microphysics. So we don't know the exact mechanism by which inflation happened, and we don't know the content of the the field content of the universe at those very early times. So if we want to answer some of these questions, it's important to, there's some information that we can still extract from the power spectrum. from the two-point correlation, but even more information is encoded in non-Gaussianity. So non-Gaussianity means going beyond the two-point correlation. So the next observable that we want to look for is the three-point correlation or the bispectrum in Fourier space. So whenever we want to characterize the bispectrum from inflation, we normally define a shape and an amplitude. So by shape, we mean a dependence from the three momenta that we are correlating. The three momenta have to form a closed triangle. And depending on what kind of, on where the signal has its maximum contribution, and depending on the specific template for the shape for the bispectrum, we have different possible shapes. And here I'm indicating three very popular ones that are often connected to, for instance, multi-field inflation or single-field inflation with non-canonical Lagrangians or with heavy fields. So what I'm listing here are the bounds from Planck. So we know that Planck has not measured non-Gaussianity. They're all compatible with zero. But the interesting thing is that there are theoretical thresholds for FNL, local or equilateral orthogonal, for instance, of order one, that we still haven't achieved. And if we were able to observe a signal of this order of magnitude, we would be ruling out entire classes of models. So the hope is that these levels will be accessible by upcoming galaxy surveys. So for example, if we were to observe a squeeze non-Gaussianity, some signal in the limit where one of the momenta is much smaller than the other two, so you have one very short, long wavelength correlated with two short wavelengths, you will be ruling out all single clock models of inflation. Now, and I will say a little bit more about single clock in the next few slides. Or if, for instance, if we were to observe a signal in this other configuration, we would be ruling out the mechanism of slow roll.
Do those statements depend on it being single field inflation or
Which statement?
Oh, the second statement really is the one I'm thinking about. Is there a way for me to get FNL equilateral orthogonal greater than order one using multiple fields and without violating slow rolls?
Yes, you can. If you have, for instance, heavy fields plus the inflaton, then you might have something like that. You might have an equilateral non-Gaussianity or an orthogonal non-Gaussianity. Yeah. If you go to the effective field theory approach, and then you start looking at higher order terms that are usually not there in the standard basic scenario, then you can have this kind of shape, for instance. So these are, of course, three shapes. There are hundreds of them, but I like to point out to an example that it shows what we can do with by looking at shapes. And in this case, we have some sort of intermediate shapes between the local and the equilateral. This is a toy model known as quasi-single field inflation. So in this case, you have the inflaton plus some extra field with intermediate mass between high and low energy, so of order H, and these models are often motivated by supersymmetry. And in this case, this field is coupled to the inflaton, and if you look at the squeeze limit for the bispectrum, you can see that the shape function depends on the mass of this additional field. And as one would expect, if the additional field becomes in the limit where the additional field is light, this will be a local type of shape, and in the limit where the additional field reaches the higher values, close to 3.5 of H, you would be close to the equilateral shape in the squeeze limit. So this is an example on how the bispectrum shapes delivers information on the mass spectrum. Let me go into my work, and I will get started on signatures of long short mode couplings that we call fossils that we can hopefully observe in galaxy surveys. And then I will move on to the CMB, some CMB observables, and to spectral distortions and to the B modes to conclude. So let me begin with the fossils. So by fossil, we mean signature of some multi-clock inflationary dynamics. So when we say single clock, we think about one degree of freedom that is entirely responsible for determining the amplitude of your primordial fluctuation. So multi-clock is something other than this. So the kind of signatures that I'm after are effects that come from a coupling between a long mode and short wavelength modes. And I will be discussing the bispectrum, and this applies to, of course, to higher order correlation functions as well. So we all know that if you have Gaussian initial conditions and you have statistical homogeneity and isotropy, the two-point correlation, and in this case I'm thinking about the density fluctuation, is diagonal. So it correlates only k1 equals to minus k2. However, if you assume that there is such coupling from inflation that could come, for instance, from an interaction between your inflaton and some other field during inflation, then you expect an off-diagonal correlation to be generated. So you would expect k1 different from k2 to from minus k2 to be correlated. And what the other thing you would expect is that this off-diagonal correlation would give you some information about this field that I call sigma, this hypothetical field that is interacting with your inflaton. And in particular, this off-diagonal correlation would be proportional to the amplitude of Fourier modes of sigma. So in principle, in this way, we would be able also to distinguish whether this additional field that is interacting with your inflaton is a scalar, a tensor, or a vector by looking, for example, at the azimuthal dependence of this off-diagonal correlation around the angle phi around the long wavelength mode. And for instance, in our work, we consider the case where this additional field is the tensor mode from the metric. And so in this way, we will be testing the interactions between tensor fluctuations and scalar fluctuations from inflation. So we will be learning possibly about primordial tensor modes from non-Gaussian effects. So what one can do if this correlation is there, so if this contribution is there to the two-point correlation, one could use this two-point correlation, and I need to stress that the long wavelength mode that I'm talking about is sub-horizon, because if we were super-horizon, we would not be able to distinguish the K1 from the K2. We wouldn't, well, by sub-horizon or smaller than the volume of your survey. So if you are in this situation, then in principle you could estimate the amplitude of the Fourier mode of this extra field that is interacting with your inflaton. And in this case, my extra field is the tensor mode, and so one can build an estimator for gamma. And here, this is just a naive estimator, but one can do better, and you can build an optimal estimator. So what I'm doing here, I'm summing over the short wavelength modes, k and k minus a little. So big K is the long wavelength mode, small k is the short wavelength mode. And so I'm summing over all of these deltas, which are weighted by some quantity. And then from here, you can build an optimal estimator for the amplitude of, in this case, the tensor power spectrum. So here I'm writing my tensor power spectrum as a fiducial power spectrum plus an amplitude. And so by squaring this estimator gamma for the amplitude of the tensors, I would derive then an estimator for the amplitude of gamma. So for the amplitude of the power spectrum of gamma. And so this is an example of what we could be estimating from these off-diagonal correlations. And so, for example, if you're, of course, in these quantities, your model enters. For example, if your tensor scalar-scalar correlation is given by some amplitude beta times the power spectrum of tensor, power spectrum of scalars, then one can compute the variance associated with this estimator, which is going to give you a measure of the smallest amplitude of tensor modes that you can possibly detect. And so the variance will be inversely proportional to the amplitude of the three-point correlation and to the volume of your survey. So the bigger your survey, the higher the sensitivity you have to test, to probe a gamma. And of course, the higher the signal, the three-point correlation, the bigger your chance to detect a gamma. So this will be a way of testing tensor fluctuations, but you have to have this three-point correlation. Otherwise, you will not be able to see anything. So you're really testing the non-Gaussianity of the tensor modes. And then the next question is there a clock? OK. And then the next question I would ask is then, OK, but what kind of models then would we be able to probe? Because we need the signal to be large enough and all to be there in the first place. And to answer that question, then the first thing that you want to do is that you want your inflationary model to do is to violate what we call the single clock consistency conditions. So single clock consistency conditions are a relation between an n plus 1 point function and the soft limit in the soft limit for one of the modes and the n point function. So for the bispectrum, it will be a relationship between the bispectrum and the power spectrum, where the bispectrum is taken in the squeeze limit. So if these consistency conditions are in place, the signal that I was talking about is basically not there. We will not be able to see it. So so the question is then, when are these consistency conditions violated? So one, there are usually two conditions for these consistency conditions to be in place. The first one is that you have standard initial conditions for your fluctuations. So in the case of the tensors, you want standard initial conditions for the tensor fluctuations, and then you want your modes to freeze on super horizon scales. So if this happens naively, you cannot produce a physical correlation between the long and the short wavelength modes, because this condition here, standard initial conditions, means that you do not produce a fluctuations until all modes have reached horizon size. So on cyber horizon, you don't have excited modes. And then this other condition implies that then if you want to generate a correlation between one long wavelength mode and two short wavelength modes, that correlation can only be produced once two short wavelength modes have reached horizon size. At that point, the long wavelength mode is already outside the horizon. It has frozen if this condition is in place. And so one can show that the only effect of the long wavelength on the short ones is to rescale the background for the short modes. So that means we are not going to be able to see anything. It's not, you don't produce a physical correlation. So in order to violate the consistency condition, then you can think about violating one of these two conditions. And so one possibility is, for instance, if you have excited initial states, so at that point you can already correlate modes when they are sub-horizon. Or you can have, for instance, modes that evolve at least for some time on super-horizon scales, and that can happen if you have isocurvature modes feeding the adiabatic fluctuation. And so if you have multi-field, although not all multi-field models are multi-clock. And then in general, it's good to remember that these consistency conditions are generalized worded entities derived from symmetries of your Lagrangian, and in particular from invariant standard space diffeomorphisms. So if you break space diffeomorphisms, you expect to violate the consistency conditions as well. And this happens, for instance, in models where, well, this is an example right here, solid inflation, where you have a space-dependent background. So these are all possibilities for violating the consistency conditions and then hopefully observe some signal in the squeeze limit. And this is true both for scalars and tensor non-Gaussianity. And so it turns out that in some of these scenarios, you may have the signatures at reach for coming observations. So I guess I will conclude before I move on to the CMB. Then I would like to point out two things. First one, that the squeeze limit is very informative for inflation. And the second is that that I didn't mention, but it follows from what I said. If you have a correlation between long and short modes, that correlation will affect the local observable. So it's important to know if that correlation is there in the first place so that we can interpret what we observe locally. And then if there are no questions, I'll move on to CMB. Well, okay, the signatures, in principle, they could also observe in the CMB, but the 3D surveys from large-scale structure are really ideal for being able to observe these off-diagonal correlations. So cosmic microwave background. So in this second part, I will be focusing on spectral distortions of the cosmic microwave background. So we all know, we predicted from the theory, and we have observed it, that the intensity spectrum of the CMB is a black body, And we know that because very early time. Yes.
So, I mean, given that we haven't really detected tensor mode, so, I mean, how optimistic is it to think we can detect a 3-point function of that?
Detecting something like that. In this non-Gaussianity, there are two ingredients. One is the amplitude of tensor modes that is very important, and the other one is the interactions, how strong the interactions are with the scalar. So you need both to combine in such a way that you have an observable signal.
Right.
And in most models, that we are looking at 21 centimeters, so it's a little bit more futuristic than we would like. If you have there is also the possibility of having large non-Gaussianity with the current bounds on the amplitude of the tensor modes. But the discussion that I introduced on fossils is also true if you have other fields interacting with your inflaton. So in principle, you could have you don't need necessarily tensors. You could be testing other fields as well.
For at least one of your observables, wasn't it enough to have the tensor power spectrum and then correlate that with the scalar sort of power spectrum, et cetera? This was the zeta
gamma.
Yeah. So you can measure that.
You say you can just measure the 3-point correlation. Is that what you're saying?
As soon as you get a tensor.
You can do that. I guess it would be a little more difficult because I think it's more difficult to measure the 3-point correlation. I mean, the signal that I'm talking about is the signal in the squeeze limit. So you'll be probably in the squeeze limit of the 3-point correlator. So I would imagine that it would be more difficult to probe the whole by spectrum. But I am not really sure. Yeah.
I mean, you can measure it, but you're going to get noise. So because, I mean, we detected 2-point function of CMB, I guess, in the 90s. And we still haven't detected 3-point function. So so you can imagine there would be a gap from detecting the 2-point function of tensors with the 3-point function.
Oh,
yeah, but you're right. It's in principle. That's the observable that we start from. Like if that is there, yeah.
It's not just the 3-point function of tensors that is applied. It's also correlating the tensor power with the scalar power.
Right. But it's still, the point is a very Gaussian signal. So the non-Gaussianity is a small part of the signal. So the first you have to detect a signal, then you have to detect it better and better until you quite see the non-Gaussian part.
Yeah, sure.
Okay. So I was going to introduce the spectral distortions of the CMB. So we know it has to be a black body because at very early times you have this hot plasma with photon bouncing around and so you can imagine that the distribution of the intensity spectrum is a blackbody, and this is indeed what FIRES observed on the COBE satellite about 20 years ago. And we know that the deviations from a blackbody spectrum are really, really small from FIRES. However, we also know that if you have some kind of process that is injecting energy or is injecting photons into the plasma, then you would expect a distortion to this blackbody spectrum. So let me go a little bit into what we mean by mu distortion, y distortion, and intermediate distortions. And then I will tell you a little bit what we can use the distortions for and what kind of distortions we can expect from processes in the early universe. So if there is a phenomenon that is responsible for injecting energy or injecting particles in the CMB, in order to know what kind of distortion arises, you have to think about when that phenomenon is happening. Because if you have processes that are responsible for changing the number of photons or changing the energy of the photons happening at the same time with a high enough efficiency, you expect that distortion, whatever distortion you produce, to be erased. And this is indeed what happens at very high redshifts, below, above 2 times 10 to the 6, because this is when processes like double Compton emission or Bram-Strahlung and Compton scattering are highly efficient. And so any distortion that you produce will be quickly thermalized. And what you would observe is then a temperature shift, temperature increase, in general, but you will not see any distortion. So this will be the red line. It will be like a shifted black body. Now, if you go below these redshifts, the processes that affect the number of photons, which are primarily double Compton and Bremsstrahlung, they are no longer efficient. And so that's where you can produce what we call a mu type distortion, which is the, it looks like this blue line. This is the distortion normalized by its amplitude. So it's a little bit exaggerated, so we can see how it looks like. Of course, it's really, really tiny, but this is what the profile of the mu distortion looks like. So when we say mu distortion, we go from then this redshift here to about 5 × 10⁴, which is when Compton scattering becomes inefficient itself. And so at that point, from that time on, you produce what we call a Y distortion. So we have a different profile for the intensity, which is this black line here. And then the transition is not abrupt between the mu and the Y, because in the transition between one arrow and the other, you have what we call intermediate distortions, which are represented by these lines here, which have their own profile. And they have a smaller amplitude. They expect to have a smaller amplitude compared to the mu and the y. But at the same time, they are very interesting because they can only occur during a specific period of time. So they're very good to, if we want to test processes that are happening during that time. So in this slide, I'm just showing what the mu and the y parameter look like. So the mu and the y, what I showed before was the profile of the distortion, but you can think of the mu and the y as an amplitude of the distortion. So in a simplified case, if you have just energy injection and you are ignoring this intermediate distortion, so you're assuming that everything comes from mu and y, then this you can write a simple formula for the mu and the y distortion. And so this dz dq, dq of rho gamma dz is the rate of your energy injection into the CMB, so whatever process you're looking at that is injecting energy. And then you have these window functions that account for the fact that at a given redshift, some processes go out of equilibrium and so on. Like I mentioned, the double Compton scattering, the Bremsstrahlung, and the Compton emission. So these are a simplified formula. So when you think about mu and y, you can think about a fractional variation of the total energy density of the CMB. So, but why do we want to look for spectral distortion? So there are many, many reasons. So here I'm listing some processes that we may be able to test with future surveys like PIXI, for example. So with spectral distortion, we may be able to look at cosmological recombination, for example. So when cosmological recombination occurs, you have production of radiation, and that would affect the spectrum and would produce a distortion. Or, for instance, we may be looking at be able to look at structure formation and reionization, which will also produce a distortion. Now, this signal will be much smaller than this one. This will be of the order of 10⁻⁶ or 10⁻⁷, so it will be we know that it could not have been observed by fires, but it could be observed by things like PIXI. For cosmological recombination, we are of the order of 10⁻⁹, so it's not well within the sensitivity bounds of PIXI, but it's close. And then you can test more exotic things. So we know that these things happen, but we can also test other things. We can test dissipation of magnetic fields, or we can test decay and annihilation of particles or interactions with among particles. So we may have a handle, thanks to spectral distortion, on some beyond the standard model physics that we want to discover. So I will say a little bit about one application of this case, and then I will focus on how we can use the spectral distortions to test inflation, so primordial fluctuations. So for decay and annihilation of particles, this is just a case study for gravitinos. If you think about gravitinos that are being produced during reheating, for example, then these gravitinos would be, their number density will be related to the reheating temperature. And if we think that these gravitinos are decaying during the distortion eras, and if they are decaying into particles that can interact with into charged particles or into photons, then they their decay products may produce a distortion. And this is the case that I've been looking at. So there are many different cosmological bounds on gravitinos. And in this slide, I am comparing the distortion spectral distortion bounds from an experiment like Bixi with the current bounds from BBN. So this region will be excluded. This region is already excluded by BBN, and this is the sensitivity bounds for spectral distortions. And this is for a very simple case of a gravitino decaying into a photon plus protino. So it's an example to just to point out the strength of upcoming observations for constraining beyond the standard model scenarios like this. So in this case, I'm representing on the y-axis the reheating temperature, which is related to the, as I mentioned, will be related if gravitinos were produced during reheating to the number density of gravitinos, and on the horizontal axis I have the mass. And so to a given mass corresponds to a given decay time. And so this is the kind of bounds that we would be able to place in this simple setup. And of course, this discussion can be extended to whatever beyond the standard model particle you can imagine that is decaying during the distortion eras, and possibly also to the study of dark matter, as already some people have already started looking at. Yes?
So, I mean, this is saying that even spectral distortions, you can do a lot better than just considering the energy that gravitinos would inject that would spoil BBN, for instance.
Yes. At least in this case, in the simple cases, yes. The BBN bounds so far were the most competitive, but it looks like they won't be the strongest bounds if we get to have Big C or things like that. Yeah. I think actually the bounds will be stronger if one does a more complete analysis, because I only took one particle, one gravitino decaying, and then I took that energy of the photons and I treated it as the energy injection. So it's like the easiest case you can think of, but if you start thinking about more complex cases, then I would think that you might even get a stronger sensitivity limit.
Other decay channels
or particle cascades and things like that. Okay, so let me move on to what we can do with spectral distortions and how we can use it to test early universe fluctuations from inflation, for example. So as I mentioned, during inflation, we have your primordial fluctuations are stretched outside the horizon. They freeze. But at some point after inflation, the horizon starts growing again, so these fluctuations will re-enter. And when they re-enter, we know that there is such a thing as photon diffusion damping, and so the fluctuations are damped. And this is why we have, for instance, a damping tail in the CMB. So when you think about the damping of primordial perturbations on sub-horizon scales, you can picture the process as a mixing of black bodies of different temperature. So if you have a primordial fluctuations, there's going to be some hot and some cold regions for your CMB photons. So, but the CMB photons are not still; they're just moving around. They're random walking due to Thomson scattering. They're undergoing Thomson scattering, and so at some point, these hot and cold photons are going to mix. And then when they mix, basically you are erasing the fluctuation. And this can be parameterized as a effective energy injection from the fluctuations into the CMB. It's not an actual energy injection like having a decaying particle, but you can parameterize it that way. Because the essential thing is that if you mix two black bodies with different temperature, you're gonna obtain a distorted black body. So in particular, it would be a Y distortion. Initially. Then if you are in the mu distortion era, it's going to become a mu distortion and so on. So you can parameterize the effect of primordial fluctuations on the distortion, on the CMB spectrum, on the CMB blackbody spectrum in this way. So this is the effective heat of the damped by the primordial fluctuations into the CMB in this proportion to the power spectrum and in this proportion to this exponential, where KD is your diffusion damping scale. And of course, the damping scale is going to go this is KD, so it's the inverse of diffusion damping scale, and it has a redshift dependence. And from here, you can derive these numbers. So with mu distortion, we will be able to test fluctuations between 50 and 10 to the 4 megaparsec inverse. And with wide distortion, we'll be able to go between 1 and 50 megaparsec inverse. So we will be looking at scales that are much smaller compared to the ones that we test with the CMB, which are between, say, 10 to the minus 4 and 10 to the minus 1 megaparsec inverse. So this is interesting because we will be looking at a separate window on inflation, separate from what we observe with the temperature and polarization anisotropies. And we will be probing another 10 inflationary e-folds in principle. So this will be adding up to the current 7 e-folds that we can access. So this is an example of what we can do with the future experiment. So if you take a primordial power spectrum parametrized in terms of a spectral index and its running, and if you take the bounds from Planck on an S and on the running, the sensitivity for a mu distortion, it will be 1 over n times 10 to the minus 8, where n is equal to 1 for Pixie and to 10 for Prism. And because for this value of an S, the order of the heating of the would be of 10 to the minus 8, you can see that already with Pixie will be very, very close to this limit. And with an experiment with a 3 times Pixie sensitivity, we would have a guaranteed discovery because we would either detect the power spectrum on small scale, the effect of the power spectrum on small scale, or if we don't, that means that this is not true anymore, and so we will be excluding the single field slow roll or say the simplest inflationary scenarios at 95% confidence level. So this is the perspective that we have for power spectrum on small scales. And of course, if you have some process that produces some extra power on small scales, that would be very easily detectable then. Because in this case, I have considered the simplest case where there is no running and the power spectrum is red. So it becomes smaller and smaller on small scales. But if you have some particle production or some other mechanism that produces an enhancement in the power, then you can do much better with upcoming experiments. So here, for example, I'm representing a power spectrum that has some bump, and this bump could come from particle production or from other things. And then and these are the bounds that an experiment like Pixie will be able to place. An interesting thing is that these bounds on small scales will be competitive with respect to those from primordial black holes and ultra-compact nihilos, which are the other two things that we look for if we want to constrain primordial inflation on small scales. But this, with these objects, you have a strong degree of model dependence because it very much depends on your model for primordial black holes or for the ultra-compact nihilos. So even though you can go to a larger, even smaller and smaller scales, the bounds will be even weaker.
Just a quick question.
Yes.
So one side of it, are you saying that in the simplest slope field scenarios, something like 3 times better metrics and sensitivity, you will be measuring.
If you don't, it means that your power spectrum is even redder on small scales. And then you have to go and look for a mechanism that does that, because that's not what we predict. Based on the simplest scenario. Yeah, that's nice. Okay, so even more interesting, even though more futuristic, is what we can do for non-Gaussianity. So in this slide, I'm showing that you can construct if you cross correlate the temperature fluctuations on large scales with special variations in the distortion. So this is not going beyond the monopole and looking at special variations of mu and y. If you correlate these two things, then you are effectively probing a squeeze limit non-Gaussianity. So you can think of it is very easy to understand. If you think of mu as a probe of your primordial power spectrum, so mu is proportional to the integral of the power spectrum. And then if you think that such a thing exists, there is a squeeze limit on Gaussianity, so there is a correlation between the long and the short modes, then the power spectrum on small scales will be modulated by your long wavelength fluctuation. And so that means that if you the variation in the power spectrum correlated with the long wavelength fluctuation will be proportional to FNL in the squeeze limit. Now, of course, this FNL is not the same FNL that we constrain with the CMB in principle, because it's the one measured on small scales, so on muon Y distortion scales, but it's still coming from a squeezed signal. So I'm connecting to the first part of my talk. Of course, this is more futuristic, and in fact, we can see that from, for instance, from these estimates. So this is in a very simple case where you have local ansatz for non-Gaussianity and you have a standard power spectrum. So there's no enhancement of the signal on small scales. And this is what you, the kind of non-Gaussianity that you could measure, for instance, with PIXI, you would have here order one. If you have no enhancement on small scales, you have order one, so you would be looking at 100, FNL of 100. Of course, this is for the simplest possible case, and there are many, many other possibilities, but this will be the orders of magnitude in the simplest case.
Question. You need angular resolution to see this mu distortion, right?
Mm-hmm.
But in PIXI, it doesn't have.
Exactly. Yeah, you're right. Absolutely. I should have been more precise. So when I say PIXI, I mean the sensitivity levels on the monopole, comparable to PIXI, to the one that PIXI can place. That's absolutely correct.
What sort of angular resolution you need to see this?
Well, it depends. You mean for prism, you have another factor of 10? And so you would be going down to an FNL of order 10 on the small scales.
But I guess what I'm trying to understand is, but the scales, do you look for variations of mu? So it's
I am not sure about that.
This is mu t and y t correlation.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
So you have a cross correlation tower spectrum. I guess I'm wondering what is the shape of it. Scales.
What is the shape?
Yeah.
So you're correlating the variation in the mu with a large angle delta t.
Yeah.
What is the number that you're looking for?
I don't know, is it L of 100 or L of 1,000 or L of
1,000? Ah, okay. So you would be looking at L of something like 10 to the 5.
L of 10 to the 5?
Yes.
Oh, okay. But the actual measure is not that it's a even though it's indirect, it's just the tips need to be much smaller.
Okay, so that's what that was.
You pick up the really high momentum wave motor from the new distortion and then you get the water graph just correlating over the larger angle.
Okay, so, mm-hmm. So that the larger angle is 10 degrees, that right? And the small one, I guess, is what is 10 to the minus 5. But that we don't have to see that directly.
Yeah. Okay.
So 10 degrees would be the angle. Basically, that would be the resolution you need the mu to be mapped.
Yes. Right? Yes, you do. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, in principle, you could go and just measure the variations in mu, but then you would have to break the degeneracy, if you don't know what the monopole is.
The monopole of mu.
You mean, I mean, this mu minimum that I'm missing here. Yeah. Okay, so
just a quick question.
Yeah,
so,
sorry.
Kendrick, do you know what set that 10 degrees, where that 10 degrees comes from?
I haven't thought about this clearly. I think I would guess that it was getting better. In which case, there's no sharp scale. The signal is just proportional to the log of the
Thanks.
Okay, so just summarizing quickly, we have a tower disposal, we have a large number of of scales over which we can test non-Gaussianity, and so we can go to the CM, we can go to the large-scale structure survey, so we can go to the distortions, but one important point that I wanted to make before I move on to gravitational waves is that the bounds that I've been discussing on the power spectrum and on non-Gaussianity, those bounds apply if we know the spectral distortion signal from all other possible sources, because we need to be able to subtract that. So one interesting thing that people are working on, including myself, is to evaluate non-primordial distortion. So we want to know what kind of contamination we can have on the distortions. If we want to look at distortion from primordial gravitation, primordial fluctuations, what kind of contamination we have from other possible physics, for instance, black holes or some kind of beyond the standard model physics. Okay, so in the last few minutes, I will just briefly mention what I've been working on in relation to inflation and gravitational waves. So we know that primordial tensor fluctuations are linear order imprint a parity odd signal on the cosmic microwave background polarization, and we have a bound on the amplitude of the signal, which is 0.07 on the tensor discoloration from Bicep and Keck and Planck, and then we are hoping to bring this bound down in the future. And so theoretically, one obvious question to answer is, where are these primordial gravitational waves coming from? And there are many possibilities, not just inflation. I'm listing only some of those possibilities here. But then if one wants to think about inflation, then we would think about how to characterize the signal. So in this slide, I'm listing what are the standard predictions for the simplest models of inflation. So the power spectrum of tensor modes would be probing the scale of inflation. There are consistency conditions between the spectral index of the tensor power spectrum and epsilon, which tells us that you expect the red spectrum, so expect something similar to what happens for the scalar fluctuations. And then you have something that we call life bound, which quantifies the displacement of the scalar field during inflation. So this is all interesting information, but it doesn't necessarily apply in general. And in fact, there are models where you violate some of these conditions, some of these of these predictions. And so I guess my message is, we need to be aware of of what measuring R would mean and things like that. So in this slide, I'm listing some possibilities. For instance, if you look at production of gravitational waves from spectator field during inflation, or from auxiliary fields with time-varying masses, or from gauge fields coupled to axions, in these models, you can have different predictions for the tensor power spectrum. And so in particular, you may break what we think of the standard RH correspondence. So the tensor discoloration may not be uniquely pointing towards the definite, maybe not enough to figure out this energy scale of inflation, because they could depend on H and other parameters that are related to the dynamics of the field dynamics. And so this will be an interesting possibility. And then in many of these models, you might have, for instance, instead of red spectrum, you may produce a blue spectrum. In these models, that's certainly possible, because you can have gravitational waves sourced by massive fields. And so a blue spectrum means that the amplitude of the gravitational waves will be larger on small scales. And so this will be also interesting for direct detection, for example. And in this model, you could also have a parity violation because of this operator. And so you could think of producing a... And so your prediction would point towards the possibility of observing a non-zero correlation between temperature and B modes, or between E modes and B modes. So these are some of some possibilities. And I guess I will... It's not entirely trivial, so if you're curious, please ask me. I like to look at the cosmology and and the possibility of discovery from the future positively. And I think we have an exciting road ahead. And I guess I will leave you with my final summary of the three things I talked about. And thank you so much for your attention.
In this alternative production mechanism, you still need inflation in order to keep the amplitude.
Yes. So in the models that I listed, you have inflation. It's just not the standard.
Not the vacuum.
Yeah. Not exactly. You don't exactly. You can have vacuum fluctuations and plus fluctuations from other sources, and then depending on your model, you might have the ones from other sources being larger than the vacuum fluctuation. So in principle, you can have even a low energy scale for inflation, but you can have detectable gravitational waves, for example.
So in one of the last examples you gave of a pseudoscalar inflaton coupled to gauge fields, you can actually get really huge tensor non-Gaussian energies, even
yes.
with small scalar non-Gaussian energies.
Yes, yes, exactly.
And so I'm wondering, especially, even though we talked about with your fossil fields, whether it's also possible, I mean, is it there not possible to get a large fossil signature out
yes.
without already applying large scalar non-Gaussian energies?
So we haven't worked out the non-Gaussianity for tensors. Just the one, I mean, we only estimated the one from scalar to make sure that it's not too large, because that's one of the dangers of these models, that you can produce too much scalar fluctuations.
You can get a large scalar tensor correlation signal.
Yeah, you can have an interesting tensor non-Gaussianity. And so that connects with the fossil signatures, that's right. I mean, it's not in the paper, but it's possible.
You saw a blue tensor spectral index. Would that rule out the equation?
No. No,
bigger. I mean,
you mean the basic scenarios, the basic models.
Yeah, I guess one would you, what would the conclusion be if you saw a blue tensor spectral index?
That you have some other fields probably coming in your, it's not just an inflaton in slow roll. As far as I know, you need other fields.
But it's
maybe,
also
okay,
not
maybe,
vacuum, that's what you're saying. It's not vacuum.
It just shows it's not vacuum for
fluctuations. Yeah, sorry. When I mean other fields, I mean these fields are sourcing the tensor fluctuations. But if I'm not mistaken, you may also have something like something similar to solid inflation. So you have just one inflaton, but you're breaking space leaves. So that's a very different mechanism where you have a solid expanding in space. In that case, I think you can also have blue tensor fluctuations. So they're like very different from the standard picture.
Is it such a weird possibility? Because one of the examples is just a pseudoscalar inflaton coupled to a gauge field, right? I mean, that can give you a blue spectrum.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's
supposed to say that there is no way to do that.
All right, so no more questions. That's a good
ending. Thank you.